you know, that it should be contracted in bundles so that each location would be able to provide the services with the resources that they have locally. The other thing that we said is that there's a lot of projects right now that are being financed through innovation and research funds. And those projects, you know, will provide, you know, fantastic solutions in order to be more humane and bring people together that are around, that live around the people, either to you know, say hello once, you know, on a regular basis, making sure, checking if they're okay, doing errands once in a while. They are all sorts of things that are showing that that brings a lot of benefits to the elderly and helps them maintain their autonomy. And these projects should be encouraged. Right now, they're financed through the research funds. And once they're over, although they show that they brought benefits, they can't find the funds to remain in function. So we should...
www.cKUT.ca on the World Wide Web. News,
interviews, and music. You are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM, broadcasting live. My name is Candace, and I'm your host for today's show. Today's episode focuses entirely on a panel discussion on Guantanamo Prison titled From Guantanamo to Gaza, Resisting State Violence and Occupation. Today we will be hearing from formerly incarcerated people, lawyers, and advocates on drawing connections between the detention of Muslim men in a U.S. naval base in Cuba and the U.S.-backed Israeli genocide, including forced displacement and detention of Palestinian peoples. This month of January marks 22 years of U.S. detention of Muslim men and boys at the Guantanamo Bay Prison. 30 Muslim men remain at the infamous facility. Most have never been charged with a crime despite spending decades behind bars, and none have ever had access to a fair trial. Unjust detention, torture, and abuse, the demonization of Muslims under the guise of national security and impunity are essential pieces of why Guantanamo remains open and how and why such brutal and unlawful practices are replicated or copied around the world. Today's episode focuses on tying these threads together and connecting them to state violence, arbitrary detention, and occupation in Iraq and Palestine. The panel discussion today is presented by the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we are indebted to them for their work. They are based in the U.S. Again, you're listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Hi, everyone. My name is Aliyah Hussain, and I work at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to today's event, From Guantanamo to Gaza, Resisting State Violence and Occupation. We're so happy to have you here. I want to thank my comrades and co-organizers, Ali McCracken at Amnesty International and Dr. Maha Hilal with Muslim Counter Publics Lab. In addition to CCR and MCL, special thanks and love to the Adela Justice Project for co-sponsoring the webinar and for their critical work. My CCR colleagues and I have represented dozens of men detained at Guantanamo since the prison opened, and represent two of the 30 men who remain there today. Their names are Ghulid Duran and Shirkawi Al-Hajj. Like the majority of the men, they both have been approved for transfer by the US government. Their continued detention is cruel and senseless and a failure of the Biden administration. Since Guantanamo opened in 2002, there has been a global movement condemning its existence. Together with Guantanamo survivors, family members, activists, lawyers, advocates, artists, and storytellers have uplifted their stories of injustice, demanded the prison's closure, and called for accountability for torture and abuse. We have accomplished so much together, but there is still much left to do. Tomorrow, January 11th, will mark 22 years since Guantanamo has been used to indefinitely detain Muslim men and boys in the so-called war on terror. These anniversaries are an opportunity to publicly recommit to this work, to stand in solidarity with the men inside, and when possible, hear directly from survivors, and engage in political education so that we can gain a deeper understanding of our shared struggles and be more powerful advocates. Unjust detention, torture and abuse, dehumanizing anti-Muslim narratives, and US impunity are essential pieces of why Guantanamo remains open, and why and how such brutal and unlawful practices are being replicated around the world. On one hand, I'm devastated that we're here, devastated that there's an unfolding genocide by Israel against Palestinians and with unconditional support from the US. Devastated that we're marking another year of Guantanamo and that President Biden has not done enough to make progress with complete disregard for the men who languish there. And devastated that this April marks 20 years since the horrific Abu Ghraib torture photos were made public, but there has been no real accountability or justice for the Iraqi survivors. But I'm also hopeful and inspired by being in this virtual space with our speakers today and by the number of people who are watching this right now and who have shown us how needed this conversation is. On this 22nd anniversary of Guantanamo, I couldn't imagine having any other conversation than this. It is only by making these connections that we can strengthen our movements. This is why we're holding this event today, to learn, build community, disrupt the US government's power to suspend human rights, and elevate our collective demands for justice, accountability, and transformation. Before I hand this off to my co-organizer, Maha, who will help ground us today, I want to go over a few logistics. We have ASL interpretation on the screen. Thank you, Rashida. We have card captions at the link. I think someone will drop it there. And the panelists will be discussing torture, war crimes, and other deeply disturbing human rights abuses. So please take care of yourselves and take a step away if you need. The recording of this event will live at the same link. We will share links on the screen to resources and ways to get involved throughout the event. Please add your comments and questions into the chat, and we'll do our best to highlight and respond to them. So again, thank you for being here. I'm really looking forward to this discussion and turning it over to you, Maha.
Thank you so much, Aaliyah, and good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be here with you all today. As Aaliyah mentioned, my name is Dr. Maha Hilal, and I'm the executive director of the Muslim Counterpublics Lab and the author of the book, Innocent Until Proven Muslim, Islamophobia, the War on Terror, and the Muslim Experience Since 9/11. So as Aaliyah mentioned, we're here to commemorate the 22nd year of Guantanamo Bay's opening under the guise of the War on Terror. Far from stopping at Guantanamo Bay Prison, the U.S.'s carceral violence in the War on Terror has extended to Bagram Air Base, Abu Ghraib Prison, and numerous Black sites across the globe. We mark this anniversary not just to emphasize the brutality of this infamous prison that has served as an emblematic symbol of institutionalized Islamophobia, marked by the detention of Muslim men and boys, but also because of how it has served as a blueprint for other countries to emulate its cruelty. As we mark this solemn anniversary, we do so in the context of Israel's ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people that has continued unabated with the full throttled support of the US government. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the US government sold the narrative that everything had changed. As Bush said in a speech on September 20th, night fell on a different world, a world where freedom itself is under attack. What made the world different, however, was not the 9/11 attacks themselves, but the U.S.'s hegemonic posture of victimhood that would be used to subsequently legitimize unfettered state violence. In the last two decades plus, the U.S.'s narrative of victimhood has endured remarkably, with countries such as Israel emulating the same to construct its own narrative of unique and exceptional victimhood, most recently after it was attacked by Hamas on October 7th. In order to seamlessly adopt the U.S.'s narrative of victimhood, Netanyahu likened the Hamas attacks on October 7th to the 9/11 attacks, asserting that, quote, "On October 7th, Hamas murdered 1,400 Israelis, maybe more. This is in a country of fewer than 10 million people. This would be equivalent to over 50,000 Americans murdered in a single day. That's 20 9/11s. That is why October 7th is another day that will live in infamy," end quote. By making the connection between the Hamas attacks on Israel to the 9/11 attacks on the United States, Netanyahu was claiming the same motivation: irrational terrorists motivated by nothing other than hate, with no political reason to conduct an attack. And more importantly, and more dangerously, to lay the groundwork to enact a monstrous and catastrophic violent war, similar to how the U.S. has unleashed and continues in the course of the war on terror. While the U.S. and Israel's violence have always been intertwined and connected, this anniversary of Guantanamo's opening, the Israeli genocide of the Palestinians, and reports of detention and interrogation conditions that Israel is subjecting Palestinians to that mimics Guantanamo made this conversation both natural and imperative at this moment in time. Moreover, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and Gaza all have something in common: incarceration in the context of occupation, which adds an additional layer to the already existing violence of control and collective punishment that the United States and Israel have constantly and consistently subjected Muslims, Arabs, and Palestinians to, violence made worse by the free-flowing exchange of tactics of brutality. Additionally, it bears noting that this history extends much further back than 9/11, and each country has demonstrated a sustained commitment to torture, in particular, by receiving tutelage and training from France per its brutal occupation of Algeria and the use of its tactics to this day. The war crimes at Abu Ghraib acutely illustrate the violence of incarceration under occupation. When the photos of the war crimes committed at Abu Ghraib were released in 2004, it was during a period of heightened U.S. intervention and occupation. The pictures of the tortured prisoners became symbolic of, as Joseph Pugliese wrote in his article, Abu Ghraib and its Shadow Archives, of trophies of imperial conquest and, quote, "the deployment and enactment of absolute U.S. imperial power on the bodies of the Arab prisoners." Abu Ghraib specifically represented a nexus of American and Israeli violence because not only were torture tactics from Guantanamo Bay Prison exported to Abu Ghraib, Israel trained American occupation forces in Iraq on the use of the, quote, "tactic of Palestinian chair," a stress position where detainees are made to crouch their bodies on the chair with their weight centered on their thighs. Recent reports from Palestinian prisoners and human rights organizations alike have put the spotlight on the torture tactics that Israel has deployed, which have been likened to Guantanamo Bay Prison, a prison built on the dehumanization and degradation of Muslim men and boys. The organization Euromed, for example, described the conditions of detention as an open-air chicken coop, where prisoners were denied food and drink for long periods of time. And another article in 972 magazine described how Palestinians were rounded up and detained, subjected to electrical shocks, cigarette burns on their necks and backs, sleep deprivation, and denial of access to bathrooms. Just as the Muslim men and boys detained at Guantanamo were rounded up on the basis of being, quote, suspected terrorists, images of Palestinian men crouching and stripped almost naked and blindfolded on the suspicion of being Hamas fighters invoke similar imagery and the complete and utter dehumanization of those captured. Suffice it to say, just as the United States remains complicit in Israel's war crimes and genocide, both have benefited from the cruel detention and torture practices of the other. Guantanamo, however, has continued to remain a symbol of U.S. brutality, torture, the dehumanization of Muslim men, and the complete and total evasion of accountability for 22 years. One so iconic in its horrors that it is often the default comparison to instances of carceral violence in other countries. Rather than shying away from American brutality, Israel has taken it as a green light to justify its own cruelty. Our esteemed panel today will examine these overlapping rights issues and help us understand how to chart the path forward towards meaningful accountability. So with that, I will hand it back to Aliyah.
Thanks so much, Maha. I'm really excited to bring our speakers now into this conversation. I'll read very short bios. There's so much more that these folks do, and hopefully they'll talk more about that work too. So Mansour Adafi is a writer, artist, activist, and former Guantanamo prisoner held for over 14 years without charge. Mansour was released to Serbia in 2016, where he struggles to make a new life for himself and to shed the designation of suspected terrorist. His memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo, was released in August 2021. He works at CAGE as a Guantanamo project coordinator. Catherine Gallagher is a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She works on universal jurisdiction and international criminal law cases involving U.S. and foreign officials and torture and other war crimes and civil actions involving private military corporations and torture at Abu Ghraib. Sahar Francis is a Palestinian lawyer and human rights defender and the general director of the Ramallah-based Palestinian human rights organization, Adamir, Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association. Her work focuses on Palestinian political prisoners and administrative detainees. So thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. I think I'm going to ask the first question, and this is to Mansour. Welcome, Mansour. In order to wage the war on terror and create Guantanamo, the U.S. had to propagate narratives that dehumanized and demonized Muslim men. How do those narratives still impact you and others who are released? And how do these narratives keep Guantanamo open today?
Thank you so much for having me today. Before I start, I think Maha Hilal has requested a gift to the audience. So I'll start. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ya hala wa marhaba. Arhibaw. Hayakum Allah. Ahlan wa sahlan. ومرحبا مليون. Basically, this is a Yemeni greetings to you and to the guys who are listening here. So it means peace be upon you all, and welcome and many welcome. So before we dive deep into Guantanamo and fly there, you know, it's not just a narrative. It's actually a policy. It is, you know, a policy that was set up by the United States to legalize torture and violation of the human rights and invasion countries. So before we go that and talk about, you know, the narrative, always the media try to shift the audience away from looking back, for example, what the life was before 9/11, what the life was before 7 October. So in order to analyze and to understand what led to 9/11, what led to 7 October, we have to look back years later, so the previous years, to understand what led to that. So the United States, after the attack on 9/11, as you know, the United States announced the war on terror, a global war on terror. So it seems, you know, and they announced that they will bring people to justice who are responsible for 9/11, right? And before they did, they also manipulated the language and changed the terminology of what actually happened. For example, Aliyah, you're a lawyer and an expert in that. They changed what they call, you know, torture. It is just enhanced interrogation technique. It sounds sweet, like you can drink it with a cup of milk. And prisoners of war, they call them, you know, detainees. And collateral damage, like the actual victims. So it is a well-engineered and planned and a setup to legalize crime, uh, crimes against humanity and torture and abuses and so on. So Guantanamo is still open for the last 22 years, and tomorrow it will be exactly 22 years. And I can tell you that Gaza and the prison plus time are worse than Guantanamo, because when they used to torture us at Guantanamo, the interrogators, they would threaten us to send us to Israel to be interrogated there. Even in the Egyptian prison in during the black, even in the black side, the brother would threaten to be sent to Israel or to bring Israeli interrogators. And I can tell you, in Guantanamo, there was Israeli interrogators there, and also there was interrogators from many countries. So I can say that at least at Guantanamo we were safe. You know, like when I was watching the news in 2010, after we got the little freedom in the detention, I was telling my brothers, you know, at least here we are safe. There is no drone attacks. We don't have missing limbs. Now what you see in Gaza, nobody is safe. Gaza is like a prison. Literally, it's worse than Guantanamo. Now, I'm not talking about the Israelis' prison. I'm talking also about Gaza. The Gaza become like worse than a prison, worse than Guantanamo, where people can die at any moment. There is no safety, no security whatsoever. So United States, by keeping Guantanamo open, it's like strong message that they do not abide by any law or by any conventions, and they use government signaling that they can do as far as they want. And Israel legalized its Guantanamo. By keeping Guantanamo open, it gives some kind of legitimacy, but a way or legitimate be other countries would take it, like Israel, like other countries who created their own Guantanamo with their own set of rules and so on. So what else? I went away from the question. Sorry.
No, that's great. Mansoor, and actually, that's a great segue to the next question, and we'll hear more from you soon. Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
So our next question is for Sahar. So Sahar, given your work at Adamir supporting Palestinian political prisoners, what role has incarceration played in the perpetuation of Israeli occupation and now its ongoing violence and genocide against the Palestinian people?
So good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for including me in this very important discussion. What I wanted to highlight is the fact that Israel started to use incarceration and detention as the main tool of the state for oppressing the Palestinian people much, much before 1967, the year of the occupation. Actually, it started as a policy right with the 1948 Nakba, after the Nakba and the establishment of the state. And they implemented the policy for administrative detention, arresting thousands without any judicial procedures, but based on secret information, the same policy that we saw in the Guantanamo and then in Israel today in the context of Gaza and the occupied territories, were used immediately after the creation of the state against hundreds of Palestinians who remained in the state, and they were living under military control up till 1966. Israel were using torture, arbitrary detention, and all the violations and the development. If we review the development of the torture policies in the Israeli context, we can really understand how they managed to bring this experience for the international level and how they teach the United States and other countries about the techniques of torture and how they developed from very severe physical torture to methods that cannot leave marks on the body. Maybe later we can discuss more on the specific issues, but I would say that Israel invented the terror, like the use and the weaponizing of the excuse of fighting against terror much before the United States did it after the attacks on 2001, because Israel was using the same techniques to illegalize and criminalize hundreds of thousands of Palestinians based on the military orders, that claiming that all political parties are illegal, which means they are terrorists and attacking and undermining the existence of the state of Israel. This is the policy how Israel were weaponizing detention, and it's just because it managed to run away without any accountability. We see today such extreme use of the detention as the main tool of oppression and control over the whole society.
Thanks so much for that, Zahar. Now, Katie, this question is for you. We've worked together at CCR for a very long time, and I know that you've done accountability work really on all of the issues we're talking about today. So looking forward to getting your thoughts on some of the through lines. But this question is specifically to bring Abu Ghraib and the U.S. occupation of Iraq into the conversation. So how do you see Abu Ghraib connected to these other sites of violence, and anything else you want to say on connecting some of the dots?
Thank you, Aliyah, and thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this panel on an anniversary that I cannot believe is happening, with Guantanamo Bay still open and men detained there, and a genocide happening right now in the occupied Palestinian territory by Israel with the support of the United States. So this is a very stark and somber moment. And I'm really grateful to be with you all. Maybe just picking up first, before I move to Iraq, on Sahar's comments about the interrelationship between Israel and the United States. I do think we see this back and forth with one country maybe testing out the boundaries of legality or illegality, how far it can push, whether it's administrative detention, what we've seen in the occupied Palestinian territory for almost 20 years before we got to 9/11 and the opening of Guantanamo and black sites. It had been normalized. Israel has been a testing ground for the United States to justify and normalize unlawful behavior. So we see that with administrative detention, detention without charge, let's call it what it is, extrajudicial detention, unlawful detention. We've seen it with so-called targeted killing, which is really extrajudicial execution. It's a practice that Israel has carried out for decades now in the occupied Palestinian territory and beyond. And it is something that we've seen the United States do. And the redefinition of torture, what Israel had long tried to do and succeeded in doing, the United States, under the administration of George W. Bush, then tried to codify into law and certainly put into practice at Guantanamo and elsewhere. So I think it's not simply the practices, but it's trying to change the law. That is actually what both of these countries do, and frankly have done with too much success, because they have really led to an erosion of the international legal framework that is supposed to protect detainees, protect populations under occupation, protect civilians. And so there is a reinforcing. And I think what we see now that we are at a moment of genocide in Palestine and Guantanamo, with men still there for decades without charge, who are largely forgotten, save for the incredible work of people like Mansour and Aliyah and Maha and others, because it's been normalized, these ideas. And so I think where that takes us to Iraq, what we saw there was the United States doing a preemptive strike, one that did not have the backing of the Security Council. There was no legitimate claim of self-defense, and the United States attacked Iraq and then occupied it and caused incredible damage and human suffering and degradation to that country that lasted for years, and the effect of it continues. And in the case of the United States, I believe that part of the inspiration for doing that was not solely about hegemonic power. It was also about profit. And what we saw in the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq was that these were the two biggest outsourced armed conflicts that existed. So there were private military contractors, private security companies, and of course, many, many corporations, especially with oil, who made tons of money because of unlawful occupation by the United States of Iraq. And so when we talk about the story of Abu Ghraib and the individuals who were detained there, it is somewhat different from Guantanamo and the black sites, insofar as the United States recognized that the Geneva Conventions applied there. But the degradation and the erosion of standards led to what we saw in those notorious photos, the 20th anniversary of those photos being this April. And it happened, as we've seen from military reports, with the support and encouragement even of private military contractors who were acting in Abu Ghraib against Iraqi civilians, men, boys, some women, who were detained without charge, picked up again as suspects and terrorists. So this framing of terrorism and the threat of a terrorist to justify anything, whether it's torture or now genocide, I think we also have to be careful and watch out for when there are corporate and profit interests that are also driving some of these agendas. And so we at CCR, as Aaliyah, you well know, we've been litigating for almost 20 years now the cases against a private military contractor at Abu Ghraib, CACI, on behalf of former Iraqi detainees who had been tortured in the hard site of that prison. And we can talk more about the fact that we're now set to go to trial many, many years later, this April. So accountability is long and hard fought, but we hope that we will have some measure there.
You are listening to a panel discussion from Guantanamo to Gaza, Resisting State Violence and Occupation, hosted by the Center for Constitutional Rights, here on the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is currently 6:32.
Gem Art Center is pleased to present When Big Man Talk, the exhibit. Come experience a captivating fusion of paintings, photography, an immersive virtual reality experience, and more. To kick off the exhibit, Jam Arts is presenting the film African Redemption, The Life and Legacy of Marcus Garvey, screening January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Maison de la Culture Côte des Neiges. Then experience When Big Man Talk, the exhibit, from February 3 to 10 at Galerie Lucie Michel, and after that from February 11 to 14 at the UNIA. For tickets, call 438-507-9258. Or head to jam-montreal.com and click Jam Arts Center.
Black Theater Workshop presents the world premiere of Diggers by Donna Michelle St. Bernard. Abdul and Solomon introduce Nubi Ba to the intricacies and dignity of grave digging. But when illness hits their town, they must make the best of a bad situation. Full of song, laughter, tears, and beautiful humanity, Diggers is a tribute to essential workers. Catch Diggers at the Siegel Center Studio from February 1st to the 17th. Get your tickets at siegelcenter.org or call 514-739-7944. More information at blacktheaterworkshop.ca. This is a Black Theater Workshop and Prairie Theater Exchange co-production and CKUT co-presentation.
Thank you all so much for your answers and giving us all this context from which to understand these overlapping issues. We wanted to just sort of stop here for a moment and see if any of you wanted to reflect or comment on what the other panelists have said. So if you have any reactions or reflections to.
Again, we are marking the shameful anniversary of Guantanamo Bay Prison while witnessing similar unjust detention, torture, and abuse of Palestinians in the West Bank of occupied Palestine. The panel is hosted by the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's titled From Guantanamo to Gaza, Resisting State Violence and Occupation. It's held online, and we here on the Prison Radio Show, we can link to the panel on our webpage, which is prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. And parts of our show are also available through podcasting apps. And another short announcement, our schedule has changed. The Prison Radio Show now airs every other Tuesday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. And this means that you'll be able to catch us next on Tuesday, February 13th from 6 to 7 p.m. So we're now going to go back to the panel from Guantanamo to Iraq to Gaza here on SKUT.
The illegal competent context in the war against terrorism, in the international law, you can be either a civilian or a competent. And they are managing to go away with this terminology without any accountability. And this is why we should strategize and think collectively how we can fight such practices in the international level.
Thanks for that, Zahra. And that actually tees up a question that that we had just based on, you know, the focus a little bit on the role of law. You know, really, I mean, as I'm not a lawyer, but I work with lawyers, I see how, you know, it can be a tool for people and it can be a tool used against people. And so the question is really just, what is the role of law in accountability when Israel and the U.S. have shown how malleable it is? And I think you probably all have examples, but in what ways can it be a tool for survivors? I think we've heard a little bit about how it can be weaponized, but feel free to share more. But also, like, how can it be and how do you use it as a tool for survivors in the current systems, as flawed as they are, that we have?
To be honest with you, you're asking me this question in this specific time where me as a lawyer trying to use this international law framework for more than 25 years and seeing the genocidal actions in Gaza with all what's going on with the detention issue and the thousands of people that they are subjected for arrest, torture, and ill treatment now, I'm totally paralyzed. And I'm so frustrated that this is very difficult, actually, to try to seek justice in the same using the same legal tools. So I hope that, like, big cases like the case tomorrow that should be discussed in the ICJ, or what kind of a difference that the ICC as the International Criminal Court can bring on the level of accountability, or the use of universal jurisdiction in the context of the Palestinian cases, because maybe you were lucky as a center, as lawyers, in some Iraqi cases or Afghani cases or even Syrian cases in the European courts or in the United States, but never a Palestinian victim. We're reaching this level where the perpetrator of torture was found accountable in any legal system, not inside Israel in the local system, not outside. So it's really very difficult to see how states are weaponizing international law and law, even the internal law. And this is why I think we should think collectively how we are supposed to face these double standards and find the way how we can bring justice for the people.
Thanks, Kate. I do want you to answer this question too, especially with our Abu Ghraib trial coming. But actually, Mansoor, I want to just bring you in to also answer this as someone who, while at Guantanamo, you know, your lawyer, your, you know, litigation was one way of access and sort of shining a light on your experience and others. But now, as an activist, how and do you see law as a tool that helps in this work? And if not, you know, why not? And sort of how have you used activism to kind of fill that gap?
Hey, Alia, welcome back, guys. So basically, what I'd like to say highlights something, one really important point that when the United States announced a global war on terror, now we are seeing another war on humanity. I'd like to hide before I answer your question this really important point where, you know, the attack on Gaza is not just on Gaza, it's attack on all humanity, because now, as you see, many journalists, lawyers, activists, employees, ordinary people being targeted if they express their sympathy, wearing scarf, Palestinian flag. So many people were fired, punished, police around the world. Like what we are seeing now, people try to stop the genocide, to express their sympathy, they are being punished. So I see it, honestly, it is war and humanity, and at every level, every country, in every institution. So when you talk about the rule of law, the lawyers and so on, actually those governments, like in the state Israel and so on, and they are using the same tactic, the rule of law, the law to legalize their actions, playing with the terminologies, reframing, renaming their actions and so on, and also act with impunity. So when we were in Guantanamo, lawyers have no effect. All they can do, you know, they are being monitored, you know, because Guantanamo was created outside of the legal system, outside of justice, outside of our humanity. So basically, what kind of law should be applied there if everything from the beginning was baseless? When you talk about, for example, the military commission at Guantanamo, broken system. Nothing has been achieved over the last 22 years. You know, even when you're being, for example, the administrative reviews at Guantanamo, where even are being cleared, it's just nothing. No court can order your release. You're not allowed to bring your cases before court. So the system is broken, especially U.S. justice system. So using the rule of law or employing the rule of law, it actually has no effect on those countries because they are in power. And they have also backup by other countries, like now what happened in Palestine. Israel, honestly, the way I see it, is just an American military base, the way with the fund, with the weapon, with everything. And many countries fund this kind of like a military base. And in Guantanamo, as you see, now 13 million men there, 16 have been cleared for release. Some of them have been cleared since 2009 and 10. Yet they're still there, and the lawyers can do nothing to get them out. Everything like, well, it's a political case. Well, we are working the case. So the lawyers themselves found themselves also victims of the misuse and abuse of power. So as you know, what happened in Gaza, we are saying genocide. And who's taking actions? South Africa started taking some actions. We haven't seen any kind of really international action taken from government that can have some influence. No, I mean, we're talking about people who go to the street to protest. Peaceful, we're talking about peaceful protests. People being targeted, imprisoned, detained, punished, fired. So lawyers also the same thing. So what kind of, if you have the law, you don't have the force, the mean, the tool to enforce the law. It becomes just a text on the paper, nothing. So when you, what I conclude that, you know, it's up to us all as humans to keep, to fight injustice and speak out and especially we depend on those lawyers, experts in the field.
Thanks, Mansoor, and thanks for highlighting too the predicament that we find ourselves in U.S. courts around Guantanamo, that even though they're kind of an independent branch, there's so much deference to the United States, especially for the cleared men, deference that the U.S. is doing all it can do to transfer them, right? And we know that that pressure, if it's not coming from the court, has to come from somewhere else. Before we move on, Katie, I know you have some thoughts on law as kind of a way to get accountability. Do you want to talk a little bit about Abu Ghraib and how that case is one way, but you know, what justice could potentially look like in that work outside of the courtroom too?
Sure. And I have to say, what both Sahar and Mansoor said about the limitations of law are things that I share. And I share similarly to Sahar, 25 years of trying to work, and 17 years now at CCR, often just feeling like we're hitting a wall. And that happens when we try to hold the powerful to account. But I am not willing to see that space. And I see human rights law, international humanitarian law, I see that not as a law of war, but international humanitarian law. And the purpose of it is to try and preserve our collective humanity and protect our humanity. And we are definitely fighting against states who have built this legal infrastructure to protect themselves, their power, their interests. But I do think that there are ways that we can still use the law. Sometimes it's in a lawsuit and in a case, and I see a question there about the ICC for Guantanamo, and I do want to get to that at some point, whether it's right now, Aaliyah, or after. But those legal frameworks are also used more popularly. And so I think whether you're looking at within almost UN structures, where complaints are made to UN special rapporteurs, pushing them to try and have these values and principles that are ultimately what this law is about, the right to be free from torture, the right to be free from arbitrary detention, the right for self-determination. When we have UN special representatives and rapporteurs and working groups reaffirming that every individual, be it in Palestine, in Guantanamo, in Bangladesh or wherever it may be, has the inherent right to freedom, equality, dignity, and self-determination. There is value in that. And something like the case of our Abu Ghraib plaintiffs, I've represented 338 former detainees in U.S. federal courts. And exactly what Mansoor said about in the case of the first case, on behalf of 252 people, the court was unwilling to touch this case, even though it was not against the U.S. government, it was against private military contractors, because they felt it was beyond the law, the courts, because it was political in nature. And that when you're talking about fighting wars or occupations, you know, this is not something where people on the field should be worrying about law. I mean, a pretty shocking decision. And then the second case we managed to settle on behalf of 71 men. And now we are down to the last case on behalf of three individuals who have been riding a roller coaster of sorts in the litigation for 17 years to get to this point of having their day in court. Their case has been dismissed. We have fought up on appeal a number of times. And these are men who were held in Abu Ghraib back in 2003. And here we are in 2024. And to be asking them to go back at this moment, while it's a good thing that we finally have this trial, it is also a very difficult thing. So I think the quest for justice, it should not fall only on victims. It should fall on societies. We in the United States should have had and still could have people's hearings and people's tribunals so that more fully everyone in the United States understands what was done by us or in our name and in our name to people in Iraq, to people in Afghanistan, and frankly, in many other places in the world. And I think the law gives us a certain language to talk about values and principles and what the expectations are of how individuals should be treated. We did try and hold U.S. officials accountable for torture at Guantanamo and CIA black sites in a number of courts, starting in the United States and then in France, Spain, Switzerland, Canada, Germany, and those countries were unwilling to hear a case against U.S. officials, as even as they now are hearing cases against Syrians or people from Rwanda who were involved in the genocide. And certainly those cases should be heard, but so should the cases against U.S. officials or Israeli officials. The court should be open to all. So we ultimately did bring that case to the International Criminal Court. And despite tremendous pressure by the Trump administration, we did have a successful opening of an investigation into U.S. torture by the International Criminal Court, affirmed by the appeals chamber, and that we had that victory in March 2020. I represent two individuals who are still detained in Guantanamo, Sharkawi El-Haj and Ghali Duran, in those ICC proceedings. And what we saw happen when a new prosecutor came in, he deprioritized or effectively shuttered the investigation into U.S. torture. So the courts are not definitely not the answer, but I think they are an important place that we continue to bring these cases. And that is part of why right now the Center for Constitutional Rights is representing Palestinians from Gaza, Palestinian Americans, and two Palestinian human rights organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine and Al-Haq, in federal court in California at this moment in a case against Joe Biden, Antony Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin for their failure to prevent the genocide in Gaza and their complicity in it by continuing to lend all kinds of military, financial, and diplomatic support. Now, that is maybe not the easiest case to bring, but I think it was an important case to bring. And we are fighting that case hard. We will have argument at the end of this month. Tomorrow, of course, is at the International Court of Justice, another case for genocide. But I think what this case helped do, when you saw people on the streets in the United States and around the world holding up signs saying genocide, stop the genocide, our case helped explain factually and legally why those signs are right. Unfortunately, tragically, there is a genocide happening and there are legal obligations and we need to have those enforced. So I think we can't stand silent on the sidelines at moments like this. And even when the court cases are difficult and the courts may not be ready for the kinds of cases we need to bring in order to have justice, we have to proceed. And then we also have to help and work with advocates and activists on the streets, in centers of power, in the arts, elsewhere, to try and, again, give life to the principles, the values that are inherent in these laws. It's not for the law in and of itself. It's for the humanity that is ultimately the very purpose, in my mind, of why we have international human rights and humanitarian law.
Thank you all so much, again, for such insightful and really robust responses. So there's this quote from Ta-Nehisi Coates who says, if I don't think you're human, there's only a certain amount of or a certain range of policy that I'm going to apply to you. And I bring that quote up because of the ways in which dehumanization is such a huge part of the reason why Muslims, Arabs, Palestinians cannot receive any justice, nor is there any accountability. And oftentimes it feels like what's being adjudicated is not the law, but instead their humanity. So what are the ways in which you have been able to successfully challenge and push back against the dehumanization of these communities, of Muslims, of Arabs, of Palestinians? And what, you know, what can we do? We have a broader question at the end in terms of what can we do as communities, but what are the ways that we should be challenging the dehumanization of these communities? And this question is for all of you. So whoever wants to go first.
Yeah, let me start. First of all, to encounter the dehumanization and demonization of human beings, first of all, we need to sow their asses. We need to bring, we need to have accountability and justice. So we need to see people brought before justice, first of all. Because when you see what happened now in Gaza, what happened after 9/11, first of all, they demonize the people, terrorists, the worst of the worst, and they said about us in Guantanamo. Imagine, like, those are vicious killers. So what they did, they do this kind of picture, this kind of frame of the prisoners, of the human being, you know, and taking people without, you know, suspicion, without any kind of legal process, torture and prison and so on. So again, the control of the narrative. For example, Guantanamo, I'm talking about Guantanamo because from my experience, Guantanamo, one of the most secretive prisons in the world and the most expensive one. Until that day, we are a struggle, you know, to counter the U.S. narrative about Guantanamo because a lot of secrecy. So keeping secrecy is they can control the narrative. So what we need to do, we need to encounter the policy of, you know, dehumanization by bringing awareness, speaking out, educating people, protesting, activism, and so on, and also calling for justice and accountability. This is really essential and important. You know, even now, if you ask me what close Guantanamo means, I will tell you, it's not just shutting down the physical place, but we need apologize. We need the U.S. government to apologize, to acknowledge its wrongdoing, to compensate the survivors. And there must be accountability. You know, people like General Jeffrey Miller, he was in Guantanamo, in Abu Ghraib, and in Iraq, who established the architect of Abu Ghraib. Where is he now? George W. Bush and so on. Accountability, it is part of the encounter to counter the dehumanization. But also, speaking, you know, like fighting for the truth is really hard, you know, like controlling the narrative, the media, and so on. So I don't want to go far. It's just like that way I think about it. Now I become doing activist, writing, engaging every single day, wearing the beautiful orange color. One of the things to shed light on our humanity. Because when they brought to Guantanamo an orange jumpsuit, this terrorist. So I'm wearing orange suit every single day, orange color every single day. Yes, I was in Guantanamo. I am a former Guantanamo detainee. This is who I am. I was there. So I'm using our Guantanamo against theirs. So, yeah.
You've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, where we've been marking the shameful anniversary of Guantanamo Bay Prison while witnessing similar unjust detention, torture, and abuse of Palestinians. Thank you to the Center for Constitutional Rights for bringing us the panel discussion. We heard from Maha Halal, Mansour Adifi, Catherine Gallagher, Sahar Francis, from respectively Muslim Counterpublics, Guantanamo Prison, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Adamir. Thank you for tuning in. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, you can email us at prison@cqut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are especially encouraged to participate. Folks can also call us at the following telephone number, 438-858-6116. You can even call that number collect if you're calling from within local 438 or 514 area codes. Thank you to Fed Phone Line for gifting us the telephone number. People in prison can also write to us through the mail. You can write to the Prison Radio Show or simply write PRS on the envelope, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you for tuning in. to the Prison Radio Show on SQT 90.3 FM.
Listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.